This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents
The Funny Thing Is
by Ellen DeGeneres. Read by the author.
A message from the author. Hello, and welcome to my new book. Please make yourself at home while you're listening to it. Take off your shoes, loosen your pants, make those funny at-home faces that we all do. Be comfortable. On the other hand, if you're listening to this in a more public place, a plane, a train, and a juror's box during a trial, it might serve you better to be a little less comfortable. But wherever you're listening to this book, please remember to turn off your cell phone and that the taking of flash photographs is strictly forbidden. Now, you may want to know why I'm writing this book. Well, there are a number of very good reasons, most of which I forgot the moment I sat down to write. I have a vague recollection of losing a bet to Al Roker, so that may be one of the reasons. Also, I don't have anything to do for a year as I wait to start my new talk show. People have suggested that I enjoy the time off. I'll be wishing for this next year. People, different people, not the same ones, have also suggested I read books. The fact is, I'd rather write a book than read a book. It's like reading, only you get paid for it. Otherwise, it has all the same elements. I don't know what's on the next page. It's suspenseful, yet I can control where it goes. It's like interactive reading. Besides, I've already read books. A lot of them. Well, definitely more than 7. One thing that you should know if you ever get tired of reading books and decide to write one on your own, I would suggest doing this only, and I mean only, after you finish this book. Writing a book is hard work. You can't just sit there staring at the computer screen and wait for words to magically appear. Believe me, I tried doing that for 5 months and I didn't get a single word. Suddenly all this talk of writing a book is making me feel overwhelmed. I need to take a break. Excuse me. Okay, I'm back. I went to brush my teeth. Just 3 of them. I never do all at once. That, by the way, is an excellent way to pass the time. Hygiene is important anyway, as we all know. So take your time and brush. Then floss. Flossing is key. You must floss. Don't even think for a second that you can get away with not flossing. Always floss. I can't stress it enough. If you get nothing else from this book, I hope you not only think to yourself, I must floss, but pass it along to loved ones and acquaintances. Floss, floss, floss. Now, what was I saying? Oh, yes. Why another book? Seriously, why? There's so many books already. What could I possibly have to say that needs to be read by millions or at least hundreds of people? Perhaps you're listening to this to get never-before-revealed insights into who I am as a person. If so, here's a good one for you, right off the bat. If anyone knows me at all, they know I enjoy the smell of a freshly washed monkey. Or perhaps you're hoping to learn a thing or two. I have no brand new words to put out there, unless you count fuzzlart, which between you and me is a made-up word. No insight on the meaning of life or even how to be content most of the time. I've been interested in some deeper meaning of this existence for a long time. I assume we all are, judging by the sales of books devoted to helping us find the answers. I have all of them, but I haven't found one that says anything very different. They all sort of say the same thing. I suppose I could put down my own ideas of what I think would be at least a good start for happiness if you're interested. Oh, you are? Okay, then. Number 1. Be nice to everyone. Even though you don't want to, and you may not like them, be kind, friendly, respectful, even if they're not nice to you. That way, you're not dragged down to their level. Also, there's nothing that annoys arrogant jerks more than people being nice to them. Number 2. Floss. Everyday floss. As discussed, in addition to aforementioned perks, it encourages healthy gums and makes your teeth feel secure when they're eating something difficult like apples or corn on the cob. Number 3. Try to have some quiet time every day. I know it's hard, don't tell me. It's getting to be near impossible to find silence, what with the TV, radio, kids, leaf blowers, helicopters, traffic, birds, dogs barking, your grandma yelling from the back of the car, "Stop flossing, you're gonna get us all killed!" But try to put time aside to listen to you. It's easy to forget what you want, who you are, with all the noise. Check in with you every day. or at least on New Year's Eve. Number 4. Exercise. Any form of movement will do. Stretching keeps you limber, young, and energized. My favorite exercise is walking a block and a half to the corner store to buy fudge. Then I call a cab to get back home. There's never a need to overdo anything. Number 5. Drink lots of water. I can't function unless I drink a lot of water. My favorite way to drink water is to put it in a tray, make ice cubes, then put one of those cubes into a big old glass of scotch. Let's have some now, shall we? Thinking back, a good thing to do while drinking scotch, I knew I wanted to write this book because I've always loved writing, especially cursive. It's so pretty, all the loops and whatnot. I thought about having this entire book printed in capital letters, so as the narrator, it would seem like I'm shouting the whole time. I like the idea of me shouting inside other people's heads. It makes me feel powerful. You know, it's hard work to write a book. I can't tell you how many times I really get going on an idea, then my quill breaks, or I spill ink all over my writing tunic. No wonder I drink so much. Then I get so drunk I can barely feed the baby. That's what I call myself when I'm drunk. The baby. Okay, I'm putting the drink down. Back to the happiness list. Number 6. Know you are special. How do you know that? Because you bought this audiobook. You are already 2 steps ahead of the losers who didn't buy this audiobook. They aren't special. When they finally do buy this audiobook, then they too will be special because they have chosen this audiobook, but you will still be 2 or 3 or even more steps ahead. But know when you buy this audiobook, you're ahead. Imagine being the last person to buy this audiobook. I pray that doesn't happen to anyone. If word keeps spreading about the magical powers of this book, the joy it gives, the wonders, the life-affirming, the life-changing results of listening to this book, no one will ever be the last. It will be sold forever and ever, and that will make me happy. Number 7. The key to life is balance. Think of a seesaw. On one side is give. The other side, take. If you just give and give and give, you've got nothing left. You're empty. Which means you don't weigh anything because empty equals weightless. So take is just sitting on the ground, bored out of its mind, saying, I'm bored, I can't take any more of this, which is a pretty strong statement since that's what take's job is. It's to take. And if take can't take any more, then, well, I think you see my point. And the same goes for taking too much. If you keep taking and taking and taking, you get loaded down. Taking equals heavy. So give is stranded way up in the air saying, hey, I'm way up in the air. And then take is like, so, and give is like, I hate you. All you do is take. And take is like, you're the stupid poo-poo head for giving all the time. And take gets off the seesaw to leave, and give goes crashing to the ground. And then take feels bad and rushes over to see if give is okay. And then they hug and start crying and both apologize for being so selfish. So you see, it needs to be balanced. Number 8. Minimize stress. When I'm stressed out, I get so stressed. When I'm relaxed, it's a whole different story. I find that life can be difficult. Also, when certain events occur, it can bring on stress. Small things, a car accident, let's say, can change your whole mood. Everything can be going just fine. You're at home, feeling cozy, watching TV. You suddenly remember you're running low on ice cream. Jump in your Cutlass Supreme, singing along to some classic Hall & Oates song, and bam! Right in the back of some idiot's car. What are they doing stop there anyway? It's a stop sign, not a red light. You're not supposed to sit there forever. And all the questions start flying at you. Do you have insurance? Have you been drinking? Why are you in your pajamas? Wow, people are nosy. No wonder I rarely leave the house. It's a jungle out there. Number 9. Start thinking positively. You'll notice a difference. Instead of, I think I'm a loser, try, I definitely am a loser. Stop being wishy-washy about things. How much more of a loser can you be if you don't even know you are? Either you're a loser or you're not. Which is it, stupid? Number 10. Don't look in the mirror. Ever. Number 11. Work, but have playtime. Recess. We lose our play, our fun, all of our joy. You know, we used to say, Mom, I'm going out to play. Now it's, honey, I'm going off to work. We don't see a 45-year-old man say, I'm going out to play. His girlfriend or boyfriend would say, what the heck does that mean? No, you won't. You don't see a grown-up squatting on the ground with a stick poking at ants. If you do, you cross the street. You walk far away from them. You don't see adults laying in the grass staring at the sky saying, I see bunny rabbits. That is, unless they're on drugs. So there you have it, your very own book on the keys to happiness, courtesy of me. Phew, it's a relief that's over. I tell you, writing a book is a bear. Anyway, I hope that you enjoyed listening to this book as much as I've enjoyed writing it. But before I say goodnight, let me... Oh, excuse me, that's the phone. Let me get it, in case it's important. So I'm going to put you on hold. Now. Okay, I'm back. That was my editor. Apparently they want this book to be more than 6 pages. I guess I've got a little work to do. Suddenly I'm not so happy anymore. I better reread this chapter. And perchance, floss. The Brunch Bunch. I'm exhausted. Today's Monday, so of course that means yesterday was Sunday, which naturally means the weekly Sunday brunch at my house. I can't even remember how or when we started this darn thing, but it is crazy with a capital K. You never know what's going to happen. Who's going to say what or who will show up with whom? Everybody brings something, so I don't have to do all the cooking. It's a big relief, especially since I can't cook. I guess if I did cook one Sunday, that would end the whole tradition once and for all. But even though everybody brings a dish, it's still a lot of people and a lot of cleanup. We have the regulars, Paula Abdul, Diane Sawyer, Gloria Steinem, Donatella Versace, Ed Begley Jr., and Eminem. But occasionally, someone will bring a guest. Yesterday, Diane Sawyer showed up with Siegfried, or Roy, I'm not sure which one. He was wearing something sparkly and kept calling me darling. He was sweet. One more guest would have been okay, except that Paula brought a dry cleaner, who also called me darling. I don't think a dry cleaner should call me darling. He should just call me what everyone else calls me, Miss Ellen. He brought the Haagen-Dazs, which was completely melted, and you know you can't refreeze that stuff, or it gets gross. Next, Ed walks in with Tara Lipinski, the skater, wearing a skating outfit, which I thought was weird. I made a joke. Oh, I'm sorry. I don't have a rink. She said rather flatly, I'm not skating. Then, after a long silence that made everyone uncomfortable, the dry cleaner asked if he could use my little girl's room. So M&M said, What are you, a little girl? Are you a little bitch? M, I call him M. I even call him Auntie M, like from The Wizard of Oz, and he laughs, sometimes. M, I said, don't start. He went back to pouring his gazpacho into a soup tureen. Ed apologized for being late and not calling to alert us of an extra guest. He didn't think it would be a big deal, not realizing that a few other people would do the same thing, which in turn turned into a big deal. I just don't have the seating to accommodate 9 people. I have a table for 6, and if 1 extra shows up, we squeeze in. But here it was awkward because 3 people would have to eat at the coffee table in the next room, like the kids' table at Christmas or Thanksgiving. Who would it be? Gloria said she would sit in the other room, but not with M&M. They don't get along. Ed offered to join Gloria, but no one else offered. I was just about to volunteer when Diane said she would eat at the coffee table, but only if I promised to play darts with her when the brunch was over. I knew she'd say that. Diane Sawyer is really good at darts. Like, weirdly good. We played once when we were on summer vacation in Scotland, and she beat every man at the Hound and Strumpet pub. It was great in retrospect, but at the time it felt kind of dangerous. Anyway, I was left to sit and eat with Donatella Versace, Siegfried, or Roy, Paula Abdul, Paula Abdul's dry cleaner, Tara Lipinski, and M&M. For the first 20 minutes we ate in silence, with the exception of the dry cleaner remarking this gazpacho is heavenly. He pronounced gazpacho with a soft G. Gazpacho. Not a hard G, the way it should be pronounced. I don't care where you're from, and I'm pretty sure he was from Canada. There's no reason you can't get it right. Every time he said it, and I think he said it 9 times in 20 minutes, I thought M&M was going to explode. It was almost as if the dry cleaner was mocking M's gazpacho. And it's his special recipe. He brings it every week. After the 3rd or 4th time he said gazpacho, I said, It's good gazpacho, saying it correctly with a hard G, hoping he'd realize his stupid mistake, but he just kept on as if I was saying it wrong. Even Donatella Versace says it right, and she says everything wrong. Well, when conversation finally started flowing, it was not pleasant. It started harmlessly enough with Siegfried or Roy asking why Paula hangs out with her dry cleaner. Were they friends before and now he just happens to dry clean her clothes? Did they start chatting when she went to pick up her outfits, as he called them, And if so, why wouldn't her assistant pick up her outfits? Paula just stared at Siegfried or Roy with this kind of knowing smile on her face, like she was on to him, you know, the way Paula does. Well, this unnerved everyone, and I think the dry cleaner got a little defensive on Paula's behalf. He started questioning Siegfried or Roy on his own outfits. And from there, it led to why Tara Lipinski was wearing her outfit. Tara didn't understand what he was talking about. It's all she ever wears. The whole thing escalated into someone, I suspect it was the silent but deadly Paula, throwing a pork chop, which missed everyone at our table, but flew clear into the other room, hitting Gloria Steinem in the eye. She screamed out, "Okay, Eminem, you misogynist," assuming it was him. I honestly can't say who it really was because I was getting another helping of cream corn when it happened. But anyway, all hell broke loose, and it ended with everyone leaving at once. In all the confusion, Ed Begley Jr. backed his electric car into Donatella Versace's Bentley. Those electric cars sure can build up speed. It did some damage, but not as much as Eminem driving over my lawn in his Le Mans and plowing down my newly planted rose garden. The dry cleaner was at Siegfried or Roy's car exchanging cleaning tips, and I was left with a mess to clean up. Well, my housekeeper was, but still. Tara Lipinski called this morning to see if she left her purse. I told her she didn't come with a purse, and she argued she did indeed come with a purse. I said, "No, you didn't." We all commented on your skating attire like you were getting ready to perform or something, remember? She said, "Oh, is that what you meant by you don't have a rink?" I'm sorry I answered so rudely. I didn't get the joke. Everyone always wants me to skate for them, so I just assumed you were expecting me to skate. I said, "No, it was a joke." She said, "Oh," and laughed hysterically until she started choking and whispered she had to go and hung up. A few minutes later, I found a purse in my kitchen and felt so bad I had been so adamant about her not having one. I opened it, hoping to find a phone number for her, but when I found the driver's license, it was Gloria Steinem's. Only her real name is Debbie. Oh, the secrets we keep. Next Sunday should be interesting. That's why prison wouldn't be so bad. Sometimes when I'm trying to get dressed, I find myself just staring at my clothes for an hour. I have not a clue as to what I should put on. It is so hard to decide what to wear. And it got me thinking, that's why prison wouldn't be so bad. Sometimes I don't want to be a grown-up. I don't want to have too many obligations. I don't want responsibilities or deadlines. In prison, I wouldn't have to make any decisions. Life would be so simple. It's true that the beds don't look very comfortable and they only have those wool blankets. They're itchy. Oh, and the lack of privacy with the bathroom situation, I'd hate that. Then again, they do have TV and a gym. I'd be in excellent shape, probably better than the time I trained for a marathon. They have a fantastic physical conditioning program, and it's outdoors. How refreshing. They call it the exercise yard, a yard dedicated to getting fit. You always hear that people in prison are really muscular, but I don't think I'd use the exercise yard for that. I'd probably just want to work on my abs and my cardiovascular. You'd probably have to bring your own towel and workout gloves, but that's the price you pay for absolutely no responsibility. There's also the fact that the food is free, and I always think free food tastes the best. Like when you go to those hotel manager's receptions, even though the food is taquitos and Swedish meatballs, they're free and actually pretty good. The thing with prison food that might worry me is that someone might try to poison a prisoner, and I might accidentally get the plate that was meant for the intended victim. That would be bad. But let's just say I lived through that. Well, then I could probably live through just about anything. Think what a strong constitution I'd have. And probably a new zest for life. What's so bad about prison? That's what I want to know. I suppose I'd probably have to be someone's bitch. Unless, of course, I got in with the right crowd in the beginning. Still, I'm sure I'd have to do stuff I wouldn't want to do, like rub people's prison feet. Or clean the bathroom with a toothbrush. Maybe I'm thinking of Private Benjamin or Stripes. I get prison movies confused with army movies. They both have lights out. By the way, lights out would be fine with me. I have an itty-bitty book light that I could use to read old magazines because I think you only get old magazines in jail. I wouldn't have to keep up to date anyway. Doing time means not knowing what time or day it is. I doubt I'd even wear a watch. The guards tell you when to do everything. To me, that's just another prison perk. I'd never be late for an appointment. And conversely, I'd never be early. I hate getting somewhere too early because I never know what to do with myself. Prison makes so much sense. It seems like I'm the only one who's figured out how great it would be. Granted, it's probably not all that it's cracked up to be. For one thing, I most likely would get into at least one fight, even if I kept to myself and minded my own business. I've heard of those pillowcase fights they have in prison, but they're not the kind that you have at a slumber party. They fill up the cases with soda cans and beat you severely. That's an ingenious weapon when you think about it. That's really making the most of your resources. I hope I don't get beaten. They say your best offense is a great defense, so I definitely have to be tough in prison. I would probably start smoking. That's not good, but it would give me something to trade. I bet I'd get a lot more reading done. I'd become a lot smarter by catching up on the classics. You know, I've never read The Sound and the Fury. Prison would be the perfect opportunity, and I could finally get my GED, finally graduate from high school. Wait a minute. I already graduated. I guess I could get my bachelor's degree and then my master's, maybe a PhD in something. I could really make a lot of money when I get out. Also, think of how many great friends I would make. Lifelong friends. I'd be sure not to make any friends that were in for petty theft. It would be too hard on me to lose them when they get paroled. If I did make friends that were in for a small-time crime, hopefully they would be repeat offenders. Then every time they get released, I could look forward to seeing them in the near future. I wonder if I would have a pen pal. A lot of criminals get pen pals. I guess some people love to write letters, but I don't know anyone who does. I love to get mail. Not bills, just regular mail. But nobody writes anymore. Prison would be just the ticket to strike up some sort of correspondence. I'd compile everything and make a book out of all the letters. I could call it Letters from the Pen. What could I do to be sent to prison? I wouldn't want to hurt anybody, but that would be a surefire way. Who could I kill? Maybe I would just attempt to kill them. How much time would I get for attempted murder? What if it's not enough time to get my PhD? I could rob a bank, too. Armed robbery with attempted murder. That's good. And if I'm lucky enough to get away with it, I'd have the money from the bank robbery so I wouldn't need my PhD. You know what? Now that I think about it, even if I got my PhD, I would have to work, and working would mean obligations and responsibilities, so I may as well just go to prison for life. I'd still read all those books. I'd be real smart, and I'd be less stressed because I wouldn't have all that pressure about what to wear. Without the stress, I'd probably look better, too, although who cares how you look? You're in prison. You're in the slammer, the joint, the big house, the clink, the cement Hilton, the lockup, the cooler, the jewelry box, the crate and barrel, the cork jug, the honeypot. In prison, you have nothing to do all day. I suppose you do have to make your bed, but it's a cot. How long could that take? 2 minutes? Then you've got another 23 hours and 58 minutes and no obligations, no responsibilities, and no deadlines. That is, except license plate making, and frankly, that's the easiest job I've ever heard of. Easier than comedy. Oh, man, prison would be sweet. But for now, I'm on the outside, and I'll just have to deal with it the best I can. It's all I know. My most embarrassing case scenario. The other day, a man asked, "What's the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to you?" I thought for a minute about the right way to respond and finally settled on, "Would you please leave the ladies' room?" He informed me that not only was I not in the ladies' room, I was actually in his house. Eventually, the whole mess was settled when I explained that I had a severe case of myopia, or farsightedness, as the kids like to say, but I was too vain to wear my glasses. Also, my hair had been kind of flat that day, and the combination of flat hair and glasses made me look a little like John Denver. He understood completely, first, because he was a highly evolved man, and second, because I'd already started writing him a blank check for whatever amount he thought would be fair to keep the whole humiliating debacle out of the papers. Anyway, it got me thinking. There are all sorts of books offering advice on how to deal with life-threatening situations, but where's the advice on dealing with embarrassing ones? I mean, things like landing a burning plane, wrestling a crocodile, or jumping from a moving train maybe happen 5, 6 times in your life, but if you're like me, embarrassing things happen hundreds of times each day. I'm too busy being embarrassed to write a whole book on the subject, but here are a few things I've learned about how to survive life's embarrassing moments. Note: as there are more embarrassing situations than can be noted in one chapter, an independent research company that I made up and then hired puts the figure of possible embarrassing situations somewhere between a gazillion and 1.5 bazillion. I have chosen 5 at random. And by random, I mean, of course, the ones that have happened to me within the last hour. Situation: forgetting someone's name. You're at a party. Don't ask me how you were invited. Either your host is very forgiving, or he has a very short memory. Or else he realizes that it was partially his fault. Why else would he be bragging about his new fireproof mattress if he didn't expect you to try it out? And yes, in hindsight, it is pretty obvious that just because the mattress is fireproof, it doesn't mean that the sheets and irreplaceable antique quilt are fireproof as well. Anyway, that's all water under the bridge. The same water, in fact, that you threw the burning quilt into to put it out. Anywho, you're at the party, you notice an old friend walking towards you, and you start to panic. You've forgotten your friend's name. Now, when I say an old friend, I mean a friend you've had for a long time, not someone who's really old. Someone really old is not much of a problem because, one, by the time they mosey on over to you with their walker, you'll have had time to go home, look up their name in your address book, then scurry on back to the party without them noticing. And two, there's a good chance they've forgotten their name as well. I'm talking about someone with a good memory moving toward you at a brisk pace. What do you do? What do you do? Solution. There are a few possible solutions to the forgetting the name problem, and I'm not talking about ridiculous ones like pretending to faint, then claiming you don't speak English. That's not only silly, but it has been proven to not work after the incident when you set fire to your host's bedroom. One solution is to have the same nickname for everyone. That way, you only have to remember one name. The obvious problem with this is that during the throes of passion, you don't want to be yelling out, Scooter! Or Itchy! A second solution is to say hi to your old friend, then immediately grab hold of a third person and say all innocent like, You two know each other, right? You wait for them to introduce themselves and sit back and relax. The problem with this is if the third person just answers, No, I don't know this person. Now you find yourself in the doubly awkward position of having to introduce two people whose name you've forgotten, and don't get all smart with me and try to say that you know the other person's name. You don't. I mean, you could always just say, Scooter, this is Itchy. Itchy, Scooter. But chances are that isn't going to work. The best solution? Say to her, I'm sorry, remind me how you pronounce your name again? To which she'll respond, Kathy. Then you continue your very clever ruse by saying, That's right, the emphasis is on the first syllable, Kathy. Yeah, I always think it's on the second. Kathy! I'm glad you corrected me, my old friend. Problem solved. Situation. Losing yourself in the middle of a conversation. There's a well-known saying that goes, wherever you go, there you are. It's a good saying, except for one thing. It's just not true. The reason the saying is false is that when our minds are deprived of stimulation, they tend to wander. So yes, you may have gone someplace, but you're not there at all. You're somewhere else entirely. Probably trying to remember the words to the Armor Hot Dog song. Now, the type of stimulation the brain needs is not something like being tickled with a feather. The mind is too mature to be amused by that. Not so the inside of your knees, which are always up for being tickled. The mind craves interesting conversation, which brings us back to the party and Kathy. Kathy, it turns out, is a bore, which I'm guessing is why you forgot her name in the first place. She's been talking at you for a long time about this and that, and you've just drifted off. Fat kids, skinny kids, even kids with chicken pox love hot dogs. You're kind of aware of her mouth moving, but you have no idea what she's saying. Then you hear the words inhaling mold spores, and like that, you're back. You have no idea what the conversation is, and Kathy has just stopped talking. She's staring at you, or slightly to the right of you because of her lazy eye, expecting you to say something. What do you do? What do you do? Solution? Some people might tell you that you could fake Kathy out by nodding your head and saying, I see. I'm here to tell you that that's not going to work unless she's part of 0.1% of the country who are hypnotized by people humming. The only proven way to get yourself out of this embarrassing situation is to say something about Gloria Estefan. I'm telling you, as long as you commit to it, she can fit into any conversation. You don't believe me? Here's proof. Kathy's still staring at you, waiting for a response, while you've dutifully considered, then rejected the honesty of the options. Finally, you say, That sounds a lot like Gloria Estefan. Kathy looks at you funny and says, What's that got to do with copper plumbing? To which you respond, Well, Gloria Estefan is the copper plumbing of the music industry. She's beautiful, durable, reliable, indestructible. I mean, look how she came back after that bus accident. Are you going to debate me on this? And presto, you're back in the conversation, and nobody's the wiser. Situation. Accidentally revealing intimate thoughts to a stranger. Revealing intimate thoughts to a stranger isn't always embarrassing. In fact, sometimes it's downright therapeutic. Many people pay strangers to listen to their darkest fantasies and most perverse secret thoughts. Those strangers are known, of course, as Starbucks barristers. But, like most situations in life, when there's no money changing hands, the chances of being embarrassed multiply significantly. So, you're still at the party, standing next to Kathy and experiencing one of those long, uncomfortable silences that only true friends who have nothing to say to one another get to enjoy. Perhaps you make eye contact with the host of the party, a flash of recognition passes over his face, much like the flash that sprung up from his bed when you set it on fire. His face turns ashen, not ashen like the beloved first edition books that you tried to put the fire out with, but gray and pale, and he runs off. Probably a funny reaction to the onion dip, you think to yourself. Still looking after the host, you feel the need to reveal something deep and significant to your old friend Kathy. So you say, "My underwear keeps going up my crack." You hear somebody say, "Excuse me?" Then you turn and see not Kathy, but a total stranger. You don't recognize any of her, not even her elbow or a little bit of her ear. Kathy has ditched you. "That's it," you say to yourself. "I'm going to forget her name again." The stranger looks at you and says loudly, "Did you just say your underwear keeps going up your crack?" People start to look at you. What do you do? What do you do? Solution. Deny, deny, deny. Or, to paraphrase Sergeant Schultz, one of the most beloved Nazi soldiers in television sitcom history, "I know nothing. I said nothing." So when the stranger asks again if you said your underwear was going up your crack, you calmly look at her and shriek, "No, of course not. Are you kidding? What? No." Now, there's a chance she'll ask, "Well, then what did you say?" Don't panic. Just think of something that sounds like what you said and say that instead. For instance, "You misheard me, stranger. What I said was, my bear keeps going up my crack." If she says incredulously, "Your bear keeps going up your crack?" Well, then all bets are off. It's now time for a different strategy. Attack, attack, attack. Look at her and say, "Listen, I've had just about enough with the questions. Who are you anyway? I don't know you. I don't owe you any explanation. You are way too curious for me, old lady. Why don't you go stand next to somebody else and eavesdrop on them, you weirdo?" That's usually when Kathy comes back and says, "Oh, great, I see you've met our host's grandmother." Situation. Hug, kiss, or shake hands. Believe it or not, it is as potentially awkward to greet someone whose name you remember as it is to greet Kathy. That's because you never know what physical action to take upon meeting. Do you shake their hand? Do you hug them? Do you kiss them? Or trickiest yet, do you do the complicated hug-kiss combo? What makes this combo tricky is knowing the order of the beats involved. If you think you're going to kiss on the cheek first, then hug, and your friend feels the opposite, you could end up kissing your friend on the ear, or if your friend is very tall, on the chest. Either way, it's potentially embarrassing. As is sticking out your hand while your friend tries to kiss you, inevitably ending up with a gooey, kiss-drenched hand. So you're at the party and the host is approaching you quickly. It's hard to believe you've been at the party long enough to chit-chat, have a few drinks, and eat the first piece of his grandmother's birthday cake without saying hi to the host. Looking back, you probably should have waited for them to light it, but you just assumed that they, like you, were forbidden by court order from playing with matches. Now, there he is marching towards you and you have no idea how to greet him. What do you do? What do you do? Solution. The answer to this dilemma is as simple as it is uncomplicated. Let your friend make the first move and respond accordingly, or accordionly, if you know how to play one. What's important for this strategy to work is to adopt the right stance so that you're ready for whatever physical greeting is about to be laid on you. I recommend legs shoulder-width apart, shoulders leg-width apart, and arms outstretched but with a little bend in the elbows so that you don't look like you're being crucified. If your friend, undertaking the same strategy, approaches you with the same stance, that's okay, too. I've had long conversations with people where both of us stood a foot away from each other, our arms outstretched, talking for hours. Situation. Accidentally flipping off John Travolta. Granted, the odds of this situation happening are fairly rare, maybe 1 in 8 at best, but in my book, it's best to be prepared. And since it's my book that you're listening to, I'm guessing you feel the same. So you're at the party, standing in the neutral position, ready to greet your host, when he surprises you by grabbing your arm, pressing it into your back, and pushing you towards the door, all the while screaming in a high-pitched voice, "What are you doing here, you crazy bed-burning lady person?" For some reason, whenever your host gets mad, he talks like Jerry Lewis. The next thing you know, you're being thrown out the door, being given what your father calls the bum's rush. You feel hurt, insulted, and angry, especially since your father was at the party and did nothing to stop your humiliation except to say, look, she's being given the bum's rush. So, you get in your car and decide to drive until your anger and your buzz from your three dirty martinis you had wears off. You're driving at the legally acceptable 20 miles above the speed limit when some jerk cuts in front of you, going a mere 15 miles above the limit. Infuriated, you drive past him, giving him the finger, flipping him the bird, sticking him the digit. I made up the last one. It just seemed like, for rhythm, there should be three. Then you open your eyes. I have no idea why you were driving with your eyes closed. And notice that the driver of the car is none other than John Travolta. Which I guess is not much of a surprise, given the title of the situation. What do you do? What do you do? Solution. This is an easy one. All you have to do is move your arm to your side, raise it up at a 45-degree angle, and pump. During the second pump, casually switch your protruding finger from the middle one to the index finger. Suddenly, you're no longer flipping John Travolta off. You're doing a touching homage to one of his most beloved movies, Saturday Night Fever. This, according to the unwritten laws of show business, officially makes you John Travolta's friend. So you're perfectly within your rights to follow him wherever he's going. Get out of your car when he does and engage him in conversation. Tell him your dreams, your fears, and all of the embarrassing things that happened to you at the party. And don't be surprised if after you've told him all this, he looks at you blankly for a beat and then says, "That sounds a lot like Gloria Estefan." God, what a day. I've learned in this business not to believe anything that I read or hear about anyone until I sit down with that person and hear it for myself. Fortunately, that is one of the perks of this business. You get to meet a lot of interesting people, and you get to have a lot of interesting conversations. I've been lucky enough to meet the president, and Oprah, and Madonna, and a lot of other fascinating people. So it was only a matter of time before I would meet God. And I have. What a day that was. Imagine my surprise when one afternoon I received an invitation with the return address, God in Heaven. Here's what it said inside. Ellen, please join me for fondue and Chablis. When? Saturday, May 3rd, 2 p.m. Where? My house. No need to RSVP. I'll know if you're coming. Now, normally I don't like Chablis, but this one was nice. It was dry with a peppery oak aftertaste, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I was nervous with anticipation for weeks. Finally, the big day arrived, and I made my way over to God's house. As I was pulling up, Jennifer Love Hewitt was just leaving. She's sweet. I was led into God's living room and told to wait. It was so bright in there. Let me tell you, every lamp was on. It was crazy, crazy bright. As I was sitting there, I started to think, I wonder what he dresses like. Does he wear that robe all the time? Like the Pope? I mean, he can't always wear the Pope outfit, can he? Once in a while, don't you think he throws on a pair of shorts and a tank and just, you know, chills out? And then I started thinking, I wonder if I'm dressed appropriately to meet God. I don't know how you're supposed to dress. Then I realized the obvious. God see me naked. So I just took my clothes off. Anyway, I'm looking around the living room, and in front of me there's a coffee table with two magazines on it, Teen People and Guns and Ammo, and a poster of a kitten on the wall that says, "Hang in there, baby." And then there were pictures of Jesus everywhere. You can't believe how many pictures of Jesus there were. Picture of Jesus on a pony with a cowboy hat. Picture of Jesus on the beach wearing a t-shirt that says, "My parents created the universe and all I got was this lousy t-shirt." I started to get nervous. I'm going to meet God in just a minute. I thought, I don't even know how to greet God. I mean, do I shake hands or do I curtsy or bow? I mean, do we hug? I feel close enough to God to hug God, but you know how it is. A lot of people want to hug me. TV does that, but I don't want to hug a lot of these people. You got to be respectful. So a couple minutes later, God walks in the room carrying a tray with a fondue pot and a bottle of Chablis. I would say she was about 47, 48 years old. Beautiful, beautiful black woman. We just immediately hugged. She smelled so good. She said it was Calvin Klein's obsession. We sat down and started drinking the Chablis and talking about the weather and what was going to happen to it. I asked her a bunch of questions I was curious about. What's the hardest thing about being God? Trusting people, she said. You never know if people really like you or if it's just because you're God. And people always want something from you. They want money, then they want more money. That's what they always ask for. She told me nobody ever thanks her anymore. The only people that thank her are boxers and rappers. But she said she thinks it's a little odd that rappers are doing songs like Slap the Bitch Up the Ass, and the next thing out of their mouth is, I'd like to thank the Lord Almighty for this award. Praise Jesus. Nobody cares about the miracles anymore, she continued. The miracles just go by unnoticed. What was the last miracle? She started to cry, upset that I had to ask. It was the toilet that flushes automatically, she said, her eyes welling up with tears. Before that, it was the George Foreman grill. The fat just drips right off. Well, I guess it was the Chablis making me feel more relaxed or something, but I was loosened up enough to say, God, I have to admit, I really felt alone a lot. I felt like you didn't exist. I just didn't believe in you for a while. She said, do you remember that day you were walking on the beach? I said, yeah. Well, I was there. But there was just one set of footprints. She said, I was on your back. I thought I felt heavy that day. I thought it was water retention. No, she said. Know that when you are bloated, I am there. That comforts me. I'm not going to bore you with everything. We talked about so many things. She told me the meaning of life, stuff like that. Suddenly, in the middle of our conversation, she got up and gently put her arms around me and said it was time for me to go. She had another visitor arriving at 3:30, God explained, and had to wash out the wine glasses and prepare more fondue. As I waved goodbye to her, I had such a feeling of inner peace and tranquility. I got into my car and noticed that Henry Winkler was walking up to God's door. He gave me a funny look, but it might have been because I was still stark naked. But who cares? I felt free, finally having a clear picture of just how precious life is and why we shouldn't let ourselves be strangled by doubt and fear. I also learned something just as valuable. If I could meet God, I thought, I could meet just about anyone or do just about anything. There's no reason to live a life of regret. If I really put my mind to it, if I truly believe, one day I could learn how to macrame. I can only pray. Gift Exchange, or The Art of Believable Acting. Author's Note. Although I've specified the holidays in this chapter, you can apply this advice to all gift-giving and getting situations, except Arbor Day. When it comes to Arbor Day, the only rules are, there are no rules. Wait, that might be the rules for spring break. I'll have to check my files. Sure, when you first heard the title of this chapter, you thought, come on, Ellen, this is one area of my life where your infinite wisdom and eerie insight are not necessary. But think about it. What time of year is the most stressful, painful, and all-around disappointing? Yes, New Year's Eve. And that's because you're finally releasing all of the stress and the resentment that the holiday gift-giving season has heaped upon your weary shoulders. The whole idea of exchanging gifts is much more complicated than most people realize. So stop denying that you need help. Unclench your jaw. See, I know what you feel like. And finish this chapter. You'll never waste another $50 on a last-minute wine and cheese basket again. Now you may be thinking, hey, Ellen, even though you're being very funny and I enjoy your witty insights and lighthearted ribbing, it really is the thought that counts. If you're thinking that, then I thank you for your compliment, but quit your infernal thinking and listen to me for a second. The saying, it's the thought that counts, was coined as an emotional band-aid by someone who left all of her shopping until 9 o'clock Christmas Eve, or the night before the first day of Hanukkah, or until right before Kwanzaa, or until the twilight of the day of the winter solstice. Please write to my publisher if I forgot to include your chosen cultural gift-giving holiday. If it's really the thought that counts, then why don't we always tell people what we were thinking when we were scrambling to buy them their last-minute panic gift? It was less than $20, and I hardly ever see them that much anyway. We don't say these things because it's not the thought of the giver that counts. The thought that counts is the thought the getter is thinking after the wrapping paper has been torn away. If we were really going to be thoughtful, we would buy presents for people that they could, in turn, give away to other people still left on their shopping lists. Your friend could unwrap your gift to find a wrapped gift with his niece's name right on the tag ready to go. You just bought him 3 hours not spent in the mall. Now that's thoughtful. It takes this kind of thought and creativity to figure out what would make a good gift for someone. You have to consider what the person likes, what they already have, what they care about, what they need. Basically, you have to invest a lot of your time. And since time is the one thing none of us have anymore, We end up giving a box set of Bailey's Irish Cream Liqueur with shot glasses with Luck of the Irish stamped on the front of them. It looks like a gift, it seems like a gift, but they never use, drink, or look at it after December 26th, or December 8th, or the week of the 12th. Please write to my publisher if the date you throw away useless gifts was not mentioned above. It wasn't like that back in the good old days when dear old Dad would spend all summer and most of the fall whittling your own train set out of freshly cut pine. That's back when thoughts really did count, and you could go to the movies all day for a nickel and not get kidnapped. But as times will do, times have changed. If you gave a kid a homemade pine wood train set today, he would sue you for breach of contract. Why people sign Christmas contracts with their children these days, I will never know. Since we can't, as adults, get away with throwing bad presents against a wall and bursting into tears, Christmas is the time of year when we all become really good at lying. Lying is just another form of acting, so in a way, we are all actors in a 48-hour play that runs from the 24th to the 25th of December. Again, unless you're Jewish, in which case you have to fake it for 8 days straight. There are people in Los Angeles who pay thousands of dollars for that kind of rigorous training. Last year, my mother should have at least received a Best Actress nomination for the performance she gave after opening a shoe tree my aunt gave her. It was gritty, real, and heart-wrenching. In short, a tour de force. Because of this widely accepted deceit, it's very hard to tell if someone really likes the gift you got for them. The eggnog doesn't help either. So here's a quick checklist you can use. You know, for checking. How to tell if someone doesn't like the gift you have given them. Number one. They say, "I love it." If they say they love it, you can be sure they hate it. Loving a towel rack makes no sense. So clearly they're overcompensating for the feelings of guilt and shame about the deeper feelings of anger and resentment they have about being given a towel rack for Christmas. Or maybe they've gone insane with rage over getting such an impersonal, utilitarian gift after 35 years of marriage. Just a tip, never give any kind of rack as a gift. I don't care how nice the rack is. Yes, even a rack of lamb. Number two, they say, "Thank you." Thank you is such a loaded statement. The nuances are imperceptible, woven with sarcasm, irony, and plain old sass. They might as well just spit on your shoe. Special circumstance if they sigh, shake their head, and stare deeply into your eyes right before they say it. They are an imposter, and you should call the police. Number three. They say, "Where did you get it?" The nerve. Why don't they just say, "Does the store give cash refunds so that I can return it and finally get something I actually want?" Quick fix. Buy all of your gifts in Japan.